It is always exciting to find shared values and teachings across diverse faith traditions. And while the tenets of the Sikh religion may not be known to many non-Sikhs, there's a lot in the book, The Light We Give, How Sikh Wisdom Can Transform Your Life, that's utterly relatable and that is inspiring and illuminating. And part of that is because of the person who wrote the book, my good friend Simranjeet Singh, who I am delighted to welcome to this show. Simran, welcome.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, so first of all, for those who for whom the Sikh religion is not something that they are familiar with, can you just give us the the kind of Reader's Digest version of so that people can come into the room with us with some background of where you're coming from and what the religion is all about?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of the interesting things about the Sikh religion is while most Americans have not heard of it or don't know much about it, it is the world's fifth largest religion with about 30 million people worldwide. It's also one of the younger major religions. It was started about 500 years ago in the Punjab region of South Asia. And the core philosophy really relies on three elements, I would say. The first is a deep belief in oneness, the connectedness of all humanity. And that comes out in various ways theologically in terms of how we see equality, non-discrimination, how we see the importance of caring for the people around us and the environment, because everything we see is divine. The second element is what I would describe in English as love. And it's a very simple connection here. And that is when you truly feel connected to the world and the people around you, then that's a feeling of love. And we know that through our relationships and the promise of Sikh wisdom is that those momentary experiences of goodness that we have through love is something that we can have in all moments of our life if we learn how to appreciate the connectedness that we all have. And then the third aspect of Sikh philosophy that I find really compelling is a corollary to these two. If you feel connected and love for the world around you, then your natural impulse is to show up in service. And so service, what we call seva in our tradition, is a really powerful practice, both in terms of it being an expression of gratitude and devotion, serving the people around you, and also as a spiritual practice for the self as a way of reducing the ego. So those three pieces of Sikh philosophy, I think create a really nice vision for what I want the world to look like and what it looks like to find happiness in a society that can also always often feel difficult.
I think, we've already gotten a taste perhaps of the light we give, how Sikh wisdom can transform your life. But I'd like to talk a little bit about your own background, because you're a Texan boy, and it's not necessarily like the first thing people think about. Oh yeah, Sikh is, obviously San Antonio, big Spurs fan, tell me a little bit about your background, where you come from. And, I think part of what I love about your book is that it's very much connected with you. And it's not like specific to you or unique to you, but it is rooted in an experience in a life. So maybe you can tell a little bit about like your own, where you come from as you write this book.
Yeah. I appreciate it. When I first started writing the book, I just wanted to share about this worldview and this philosophy that I love and that has given so much to me. So there was never any intention that I had about sharing from my own life. And as I started writing and sharing with my editor and my agent, they both started saying, well, where's the story here, right? Like we need a vehicle for understanding. Like nobody cares. Nobody cares about philosophy. We care about people. And so bring yourself into the story a little bit and tell us just what it's like to be a Sikh in this country. And, to some degree that felt strange because we all have our lives. They all feel normal to us. And as I started talking to people, I started to understand that maybe my experience as a turban wearing Sikh growing up in Texas is unfamiliar to a lot of people and some of the challenges that I've faced can help people see the world a little bit differently. And so that's the why behind sharing a bit of my story as part of the book. And you know, for me as a kid growing up in Texas, we were the only ones in South Texas in the whole region who wore turbans. And my brothers and me, you know, for in many ways, our lives were very typical, very much into sports, got along great with our friends and our neighbors and our classmates, a lot of close friendships, and a really overall a lovely childhood. But interspersed with that was daily challenges with racism and people's ignorance. And that shaped a lot of my experiences in this country and what my life has looked like today, too. And perhaps the most formative moment for me that really changed the trajectory of my life came after 9/11. And Paul, you and I have talked about this before. And, you know, this is not a unique story for people in my community and for other communities that were affected by the racist backlash after 9/11. But as I started walking around San Antonio and as people started to treat me differently, and to perceive me differently, you know, before I was in many ways just different. And now all of a sudden I was the enemy. And it's not that I had changed. It's that people's perceptions of me changed. I really had to figure out a few things about my life, right? Why was I choosing to look this way? And is it something I wanted to continue? That was a big question for me. Another one is, what do you do when your understanding of yourself is different from how other people perceive you? And to what extent do you take that seriously? To what extent do you ignore it? In what ways might it be dangerous or risky to not take it seriously? But I think, you know, these are all questions that we all face in various ways. And the last one, I think, really that hit home for me was recognizing the challenges that religious minorities in this country face, racial minorities in this country face. You know, I was experiencing both at the same time and really wanted to figure out how I could serve these communities in ways that they could have equal access to opportunity and justice in this country as we've always promised. And so that experience of my life growing up really shaped who I've become.
Yeah. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had Muhammad Ali, who is from MPACT, who was talking to us about the bill in the House, Resolution 662, which was to recognize the violence that happened to Muslims and people perceived as Muslims after 9/11. And as has been clearly demonstrated, the Sikh community was mistaken for Muslims and experienced violence and hate in terrible measures. And so I think that, you know, that resolution is still present in the House. And I encourage listeners to consider how we might show up for people who were experiencing that after 9/11. I appreciate you bringing that into them. I also think it's really important to recognize that religion never happens without people. And so the stories of people is really important as we think about, like, and really how it shapes us, how it manifests in different ways in different people. And so your experience is not the only Sikh experience, but it is like it's an entry point for many people who haven't had an opportunity to meet folks. What is one tenet that in those moments when you have felt most challenged, like, is there a piece of the scripture some sort of tenet that really has helped you in really moments where you were like, how am I going to get through this?
Yeah, you know, there are a bunch that I turn to, and they've increased over the years as the challenges have grown and I've grown older. But one that comes to mind immediately, and I was thinking about this the other day in a tough moment. You know, I was walking down the street after an event in New York City, and a guy came after me, not chasing me, but he sort of stepped up to me, and he started yelling at me, saying, "Get out of here with your effing turban." You know, in those moments, I've had these moments all my life. You don't really know what the right response is. I think in part because there is no perfect response, and getting comfortable with the reality that these situations, because of how we've set them up as a society, it's always going to be imperfect, and you're always going to walk away feeling like that was a situation I would have rather not had. But what I think about in these moments is this concept that comes up early in our tradition, in our scripture, called Nidbo. It comes as two words, Nidbo and Nidvad. And Nidbo means without fear, and Nidvad means without hate. And they're essentially descriptions of the divine. But as descriptions of the divine, they're also qualities that we aspire towards. And there's this one line that came to my mind in this moment, and it comes up often for me in situations like this, where it's really unclear how to respond. And the line from scripture is and it's essentially saying the truly wise person is one who doesn't give in to fear and who doesn't inspire fear in others. And you know, it's a tough tightrope to walk sometimes. In a moment like this, I could feel afraid of this person, and I that's the natural impulse. So how do I live into fearlessness in this moment where this person may very well attack me? I mean, he's very angry at me for whatever reason. And also, how do I respond in a way that's not hateful or angry or fear inspiring, but is compassionate to this person? And so that's something that's been really important for me personally in moments like this.
I can imagine. I mean, the title you gave to the book is "Light We Give." Where does that come from? What inspired that title?
Well, you know,
I mean, you just kind of articulated a little bit of the, you know, some of the background of how to give light. But I'm just curious if there's another reference point for that.
Yeah, you know, light is such a common reference in religious traditions, whether we're talking about enlightenment as an achievement, if we're talking about illumination in context of darkness. I think it's such a beautiful metaphor. And part of what Sikh philosophy teaches us is that everyone has the same divine light within us. And you know, part of what I wanted to do I'm a dad. I love dad jokes. I love puns and double entendres. And
so, you're like infamous for dad jokes, actually. So we may ask you to gently harm us with one later. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I love the entendre of you know, the light we give being something you give off light, and also it's something that we can choose to share with others. But in this sort of the framing of the title, in both cases, there's something implicit about we just do this, whether you choose to accept it or not. The light is inside of you. And part of the Sikh philosophy, the teaching is the difference between those who are able to find joy in life and those who continue to suffer because of the various difficulties we face is the ability and the practice of learning to see the light that's always all around us. And so that's something that's been such a powerful teaching for me. I love that concept. And so I was trying to bring that into the title a little bit.
Beautiful. You mentioned children, and you know, we had our friend Rabbi Stanton on last week, and we've had, you know, I'm also a dad. What does it mean to you to try to imagine passing this tradition on to your children?
It's an interesting question, because in some ways I think it's very similar to how my parents thought about it as immigrants. You know, for them, growing up in a country where, and at least a region of North India where there were many Sikhs, and then moving to a place where there weren't any, they had to be very differently intentional about how to raise kids and preserve the tradition. I find the same thing to be true here in New York City, where we are surrounded by incredible diversity, but we have to make a lot of effort. You know, what my kids are learning in school is wonderful and great, but they're not learning about their heritage, and that's on us at home. We make extraordinary effort. I mean, we go out to Jersey, of all places, every weekend for their Punjabi school, so that they're learning their language and their culture. We teach, you know, traditional Sikh music to them at home. We speak Punjabi with them when we can. And so it's very much how so many other people transmit whatever part of their cultural heritage is important. And I think the one thing that feels a little bit different is while I want to instill the values of the tradition that I think are so important for well-being, and while I want my kids to love the tradition that I love and want to share that with them, I also find myself feeling okay. I mean, they're still young, so there's no resistance yet, but I'm also starting to feel okay in a way that I didn't know if I would, if they come to me one day and say, you know, this isn't for me. And to me, the real concern for me is, are they engaging with themselves and the world in a healthy way that protects, you know, their mental health and their spiritual well-being? Like I would love that. That feels really important to me, even more so, I think, than the actual religious identity.
Yeah, I actually, like, that mirrors very much my approach. I would love for them. I would love for my kids to understand why I love Jesus and why I follow, you know, and why I, you know, why I go to church and why my husband go to church. But I'm actually fine with them having their own adventure and recognizing that my own path was very winding. And also, like, you know, when you say maybe this isn't for me, it also can be right now. Like, you know, there's lots of ways that we can circle around. But if again, it's kind of like if you show the light, then, you know, it's fine. Whatever, you know, as long as they have light in their life.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. But I really appreciate that. You know, it's just reality. You know, you can't force kids. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You know,
right,
eventually,
exactly.
You know, but it's also like, you know, recognizing for them why we do is actually the most important thing. Like, so that they have a good example, I think it is really great. One thing I wanted to just touch base with you that just kind of happened. Do you know the board member at Interfaith Alliance, Simran Stuhl-Panagel? Do you know this fellow?
I know of him, but I'm not sure if we've met.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he's really fine. And one of the things that has happened, you know, just last night, the Senate passed the Respect for Marriage Act, which was really remarkable. And what has been kind of this amazing cascade of Sikh organizations signing on to say, actually, we want to support Respect for Marriage Act, not necessarily because, like, all of us are, you know, support same sex, you know, or marriage equality or what, however you want to call it, but because we recognize that people are different in this country and we, you know, and we want to show up for that, you know. And I thought, you know, so there were like a dozen Sikh organizations that signed on to this letter, saying, and it actually made a difference. And so I just think it was a pretty remarkable moment, I think, for a tradition that I'm sure it's very divided within the community, but the younger generation is probably saying, is this really, like, we're going to do this? You know, I don't know. I'm curious what your reaction is to that.
Yeah, I love to hear that. You know, I saw the letter circulating amongst Sikh organizations and leaders. I wasn't sure, honestly, how people would react. You know, in many ways, the Sikh community is agnostic on issues like this. We don't have, I think one of the beautiful things about our tradition is we don't have the kind of hierarchy in other religions, and that's very intentional. Your faith is meant to be interpreted for yourself, and we don't need to make arbitrary rules for other people in terms of how they should live their lives. And so I love that about our faith. But one of the challenges then becomes when there are clear cultural, social issues, are we willing to step in and lead with our values? And for me, something like, you know, same-sex marriage is very much in line with our belief that everyone should have equal rights. I mean, I find it to be difficult theologically to argue against it. But at the same time, given the immense homophobia and anti-gay bias within South Asian culture, it takes a lot of courage to step forward and take a stand. And so up until recently, I haven't seen many Sikhs, at least not in an organizational sense, taking a position on issues like this. And it seems to be a trend that's been shifting over the past decade or so, thanks in a large part to queer communities who are opening up these conversations and pushing the agenda. But I love to hear the fact that these organizations are actually now, you know, knowing that there is risk involved, willing to step forward and do what they need to try in terms of their values.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, extraordinary and understanding like how deep that is. I want to just, you know, take a moment to recall something that you did, after the terrible attack on Oak Creek. We just recognized the 10th anniversary of the shooting at Oak Creek, the Gurdwara. I think there was a white supremacist who went in and killed, I think it was 10 or maybe more, or maybe, I don't know. I can't remember exactly the number, but, a terrible amount, and then traumatized a whole generation of people in that Gurdwara that day. And one of the things that you really have been forthright about, especially as someone who's mistaken for a Muslim, is not to say, oh, I'm not Muslim. You don't hate me. I'm not Muslim, you know, which would be a really easy way to kind of approach that moment. And instead to say, like, actually, that's not the right response at all. And so I don't know. I'd love for you to kind of, you also have made, you know, for a while you were a professor and teaching Islam, which is, I think, quite unusual for a Sikh to teach Islam. So I just think that, you know, what you do is you continue to use your spiritual and religious background to cross bridges that are hard to cross, frankly, and to take stands that sometimes will, not everybody's going to go there with you, but you take them nonetheless and lead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think any of this is all that remarkable, at least in terms of our tradition. We have many examples of our leaders showing us what it looks like to step up for other people in their time of need. And it might mean that you are more at risk for harm for yourself, but that's something that you should be willing to do if you truly believe in justice for everyone. And the term we use for that in our tradition is sarbat dafala, which means the upliftment of all humanity. And of course, I care about my community. Of course, I would love for Sikhs to have more safety and security in this country and all over the world. But our worldview is, you know, just because I am of one particular religious, I'm not better than anyone who is not Sikh. I don't deserve more than anybody who is of a different religion or a different race. And so really trying to live into that. And, you know, it was one of the funny things that would come up when I was teaching Islamic studies in Texas in 2016, I think I started. And people would come up to me all the time and be like, well, you look like a Muslim, and you're holding a Quran, but you're saying you're something else. And we've never heard of this other thing, but like, you're just confusing people.
Are you trying to trick us?
And now I have a different challenge, which is I teach Buddhist history at Union Seminary. Oh, wow. And for me, I mean, my main role maybe speaks to this in a way that might make sense for people. But right now I serve as the executive director for the Religion and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. And our focus is to ensure that everyone, regardless of what they believe or how they pray, or even if they don't believe, and if they don't pray, making sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to thrive, to find happiness in our society. And while that has been our goal for a long time, the unfortunate reality is we haven't reached it. And so for me, it really is my life's mission to help at least get us closer to that goal. I don't think we're close enough yet that it feels achievable, within the next year or within the next decade, but hopefully we can continue going in the right direction rather than going the other way around.
Yeah. Well, I know that you, I know that they are lucky to have you steering that ship, and do know that the Interfaith Alliance is looking forward to partnering with you in all ways that make sense, and looking forward to that in the future. So
same.
We are celebrating your book, of course, The Light You Give, but also we wanted you to have a chance to give some light on some books in 2022 that you loved. So what are some books that you want to make sure our listeners hear about?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of my favorite books that I just read is by one of my favorite poets. He has a new collection of essays called Inciting Joy by Ross Gay. I had the privilege of sitting with him at the Texas Book Festival and doing a panel together, and just really, really enjoyed seeing his thoughts that in many ways mirrored some of what I believe in terms of finding happiness in our daily lives.
Can you say the name of the author one more time?
His name is Ross Gay, and the book is called Inciting Great. Joy. There's a book that is on a different wavelength by someone named Mary Frances O'Connor. It's called The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. But I love it because it's a topic that I don't think about too often, for many reasons, but you know, as we all go through difficulties in our life, trying to understand what our brains are going through the process, I found to be really insightful and compelling. So that was a really nice book as well.
That's really, say the name one more time.
The book is called The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss.
By
Mary Frances O'Connor.
I only ask you to do this twice because I know that when I'm listening to the radio and someone says something, I miss it always the first time. So we really, these are great suggestions. What else are you going to lay on us?
Okay. The last one is a book that I read last year, but if you haven't read it yet, I would highly recommend it. It's Kathy Park Hong. Her book is called Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. And in the context of growing anti-Asian hate, and in a context where we're trying to learn more about Asian American experiences and perspectives, I found this to be a really beautiful, personal, vulnerable book that revealed quite a bit about an experience that, you know, in a way that I have as a South Asian, but coming from a different perspective and really, really instructive for me. So I just love the book.
Say it one more time.
It's Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning by Kathy Park Hong.
Thank you so much. Those are so helpful and just a beautiful range of offerings. So we just really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Simran.
Of course. Of course.
Okay. Last but not least, you know, to usher out the, you know, the 2022, why don't you lay on us a couple of your best dad jokes?
Oh, so, okay. The word being a sick, you know, it's S-I-K-H, but pronounces, I mean, there are tons of good jokes there. So, you know, sick is an easy word to play with. I thought that growing up, I had a really unique nickname. In the 90s, everyone called me Turbinator. And then I realized pretty much every sick in the country was called Turbinator. So then I had to come up with a new one. And in grad school, when I was at Harvard Divinity, our soccer team, they helped me come up with a new one, and my nickname was The Sickness. So that was a good one as well. And the last thing I want to say about all of this is you might think that this is just me trying to figure out all these jokes, but I think there's something innate about this because I'm Punjabi. So that's, I think that's where it comes from, my Punjabi background.
Ooh. Oh no. Okay. All right. So don't quit your job at Union. Don't quit your job, at the Aspen Institute. Let me just, but do continue to write, do continue to, you know, to lay on us all this wisdom. We really, really appreciate it. Dr. Simranjeet Singh is Executive Director for Religion and Society Program at the Aspen Institute and a visiting professor of History and Religion at Union Theological Seminary. He is a columnist for the Religion News Service, and his work has appeared in New York Times, Washington Post, and on CNN. Simran, thank you so much for taking time for State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Paul. Great to spend some time with you.
We've heard some great recommendations of other books from our guests this week. I have a few of my own. I want to highlight some books on Christian nationalism that I think are very important. This has been a major focus for Interfaith Alliance this year. One of them is Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, an updated edition by Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry. Another one is The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. This is by Philip Gorsuch and Samuel Perry. And the third is The Seven Deadly Sins of White Christian Nationalism, A Call to Action by the theologian Carter Haywood. I also want to mention Subversive Habits, Black Catholic Nuns in the Long African-American Freedom Struggle by Shannon D. Williams. And one more book by my friend and former colleague at Interfaith America, A Time to Build. This is by Eboo Patel, and a beautiful book about how to build things in this country when we talk so much about how things are falling apart. And finally, I want to mention a book by a friend of mine whose name is Grace Shulman. The book is called Again the Dawn, New and Selected Poems from 1976 to 2022. She is an extraordinary woman who has been writing poetry for decades now. I had a chance to hear her read recently, and I'm going to read just the opening to one of her poems called God Speaks. Before the hour I cried, let there be light, I tossed out some 300 earlier versions. Revisions help. What clatter in the firmament, though, when mountains fell, stars fizzled out. This work is my best, at least for now. I called, I named each thing, and it was so. I cannot tell you how, from heaven to seas to people, all sprang up. Wanting to be. It goes on, and I encourage you to look at Grace Shulman's book, Again the Dawn. And with that, I'm afraid that's all the time we've had for this week's show. We need your help keeping the show on the air, and I hope you'll consider being a partner in this crucial work by making a financial contribution today. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And you can also be a part of making sure informative and encouraging voices like the ones we heard today are heard by sharing this program with your friends and family. Let's get more people listening and more people taking part in these conversations, both on and off the air. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the weekly State of Belief podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. And join the conversation. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at State of Belief and share State of Belief with people in your life. State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week. I can't wait. Until then, I'm Paul Rauschenbusch, and that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.